You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the network, its advertisers, owners, or sponsors.
All right. Hey, everybody. We are back. This is securityjabber.com. What a day today. I got an iPhone X. Is that a 10 or is it an X?
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyways. I have one too. I don't know what to call it. It's better than everybody else.
Bill?
That's how I feel.
I'm
going to
call mine Bill or Betty or Betsy.
The threat of you getting
an Lucretia.
The threat of you getting an iPhone X is the main reason why I went and got one, because I couldn't sit next to you on this podcast and look at your brand new phone and be like, he's got something better than mine.
Phone envy.
Yeah.
This is Dave Glenn, your intrepid host, joined by my equally important co-hosts.
Matt Thompson.
Dan Gregory.
Guest host this evening.
Michael Scalfani.
And very special guest.
Rachel Snyder.
Where are you from, Rachel?
Little Caesars.
I was just going to make a smart remark about, anyway. Sorry.
There's so many ways.
So we're going to get to Rachel in terms of an interview, because I know you're all wondering who she is and how she got here, but we're going to do that in our last segment episode tonight. But to start things out, this has been on everybody's mind a lot. I think this whole explosion of cryptocurrencies has been on everybody's mind a lot. From John McAfee making his ridiculous pronouncement that he's going to eat a part of his own body if it doesn't go to $1 million in by 2020.
Yeah.
Is that dude going to make it to 2020?
I think he's probably already dead, actually.
He's going to go Silence of the Lambs on us.
Hannibal Lecter. Wow. Red rum. Nice. Anyway, but people are saying cryptocurrencies are like Bitcoin are the bubble to end all bubbles. Mike, when we were looking into Bitcoin farming?
Fall of 2013.
And how much was it then?
Under 50.
I was under 50 bucks.
I think so, yeah.
Under $50. So I know someone that actually invested like $50,000 in Bitcoin way back when. Think about that. If it goes to where this clown is saying it's going to go, what is that? Like $1.8 billion or something? Anyway, ridiculous. So what do you guys think about cryptocurrencies? First of all, does anybody have a really solid elevator explanation of cryptocurrencies? Anybody?
An elevator explanation?
Yeah. What's cryptocurrency?
You're in an elevator and I ask you.
it's kind of like peer to peer version. It's kind of like the torrent version of currency, but it's being mined by computers that are using this algorithm on a preset number of bitcoins that will be created, and it's all these computers working together like in a torrent system that are certifying the transactions, and by certifying those transactions, it creates a new Bitcoin in the process that gets shared by the computers that created that transaction log. So it's a set number that's not going to expand, but it's limited based on the algorithm that was set up in place by the creator of Bitcoin.
So there's a finite number of Bitcoins that can exist.
And 21 million. And there's no governing body. There's no governing body, right?
Nobody
knows who invented it. This is the biggest mass hallucination. I don't know what I'm talking about. But really, when you think about paper currency, once we went away from the gold and silver standard, our paper currency is really kind of this we've committed to the fact that this idea that this paper has value. Now our federal government can print as much of it as they want, and I kind of make fun of that sometimes. This whole idea that it is kind of this we all believe in it, so the money's real. This seems to me to be even more or even less real, even less substantial. So I wonder, it's funny, I'm on this text thread with some other executives where these guys are talking about, one of them talked about how when it was down at 5,000, he invested a bunch of money in it, and he's pretty excited that it's up to 18 grand or 19, whatever it is, whatever it's sitting at right now. Somebody else on the thread said, yeah, good luck. You're investing in vaporware.
How's that any different than Google or Netflix stock or Apple stock?
There's no product. There's nothing.
Yeah, there is. It's using electricity, right? So this is a very electrically intensive process. And the miners that are doing this are very limited. Like back in the day, back I think 2010, 2011, at the early part, somebody like you or me in our own house could actually mine it. Nowadays, you can't. There's investment firms that are putting millions of dollars into server rooms with, you know, water cooling and air conditioned.
Yeah, we covered that a couple episodes. Right now, Bitcoin is using as much energy as 159 other countries.
Yeah,
in the
exactly.
World combined.
So that's wow. The process that's backing it. Like the U.S. dollar is backed by the petrodollar and the U.S. military.
I get it.
So it's a weird concept to think of what's backing it. But
I understand what you're saying. And we talked about power being cheap and in China and people not being worried about polluting the atmosphere with their carbon emissions or whatever. But I think that's, this has value because we've placed intrinsic value on it. There isn't.
Well, I think the bigger value here is that what gives it value is the black market and basically most of the big transactions are being used for Bitcoin right now are being used for bad things. They're being used for terrorism, drug, human trafficking. And so you start to get a moral compass on this and say, well, yeah, I'm going to make a ton of money on Bitcoin, but what is my investment in Bitcoin actually buying in these transactions? In a way, it'd be like buying stock in a company that sells machines or, you know, information in North Korea. That's how I would see it. I mean, it doesn't draw that direct line, but I think at some point that's going to start coming up. And you'll get investment firms doing Bitcoin, and some hacktivist is going to get involved. And they're going to say, well, who's actually using Bitcoin? Who's actually using these? As a federal agencies, we've seen it over the last year and a half or so, they're really tightening down on Bitcoin operations. And you're also seeing hackers go after the exchanges. And one day you have tons of Bitcoins, the next day you have zero Bitcoins. And guess what? It's not backed by anything. So if someone steals those keys, someone steals your Bitcoins, there isn't a way to remediate that. You're just, well, you're out of Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, and so NiceHash, that's another primary example. NiceHash just got hacked for $70 million. Somebody made off with $70 million dollars in cryptocurrency. There's absolutely no recourse. There's nothing they can do. It's just gone.
Well, so that's why a lot of people don't even keep them on exchange. You keep it in your own private wallet off of any kind of a Bitcoin exchange.
Doesn't it become more anonymous at that point?
Correct, yeah. Mm. So a lot of people, they'll either put on a secured, encrypted USB drive, or they'll actually just keep it on a piece of paper and they'll keep that in a safe or somewhere secured with their own personal Bitcoin.
Yeah, but if you're an investment firm, is that going to be your plan? I mean, then that's sure. What we're talking about is you're injecting big dollars into this. At what point do the investment companies...
So I think the issue of Bitcoin, you need to look at it two ways. Is it a way for people to get rich quick, right? Some people are looking at this as an investment opportunity. Other people are looking at this as a means to secure their financial assets. So think of people in China or other countries where there are financial regulations that are clamping down on what they can do with their excess wealth. Mm-hmm. So people in China that want to take it out of the Chinese economy, they can't just take it out in cash or in gold bars and skip the country. But what they can do is you put it on a USB drive, you go to another country, Canada, Europe, and you have your millions on your USB drive and you can cash it out that way. So I think there's two different ways to look at this.
That's kind of interesting. Smuggling money out of that. You just brought something up interesting.
X-ray your USB drive and it's flash.
No, yeah, right. But when you think about it, that's a lot of people, you know, you take more than $10,000 through customs and you could be in trouble. That's kind of interesting because you throw a USB key in your pocket, you walk right through and you're golden. That's interesting. I didn't think about currency smuggling.
And I believe in the U.S. now they're looking at tax regulations for Bitcoin. So I saw something, there's something on the stock exchange now for Bitcoin or Bitcoin Foundation. I didn't get enough time to research it, but it parallels the general Bitcoin as well.
Hmm. So
this is just one of many, right?
So we've got Zach Sarukin, I can't say his name. Coming into, is that next?
Zarukin.
Is that the next episode? I think he's at his holiday party right now or else he would be here talking about this stuff. But, Zach actually mines Bitcoin and he, after everything's paid for and all that other stuff, he heats his house with it. Because it's so hot. He's actually heating his house with it. And I think he nets, I'll let him talk about it, but he nets a very small amount of money every month. But it is, but he's actually mining Bitcoin in his house. Sort of an interesting thing. The legitimacy of the currency. It's kind of like we were talking about net neutrality last week. It's interesting, or a couple weeks ago, it's interesting how this is another one of those things that you can't really regulate, but you could regulate how people are trading in currency for it.
I have a question. So about this being in a bubble, what would constitute it being in a bubble? So when I think of a bubble, I think of, you know, where a mass of people are getting into something is just raising the price to extraordinary value. Mm-hmm. But right now, I think the average person hasn't even heard of Bitcoin until this week when, you know, mainstream media started talking about 20,000 Bitcoin. And if you talk to the average person, hey, what's a Bitcoin? Like, oh, isn't that that one electronic coin or something? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we're actually in a bubble phase right now. I think it's still too new of a concept.
That's the beauty of a bubble, is that it happens behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. When everybody was buying insurances on mortgage rates, we knew nothing about that. It's investment firms and hedge funds that are dumping my 401k or 401k money in there. And that's what's going to cause a bubble. And that's what UBS is saying.
Hang on. That's what's going to cause a bubble, or that's what's going to cause the bubble to pop?
That's what's going to cause the bubble to pop, is that hedge funds and other investment firms are dumping money and inflating the price of this. And at some point, something's going to happen and all that's going to collapse.
Part of the interesting thing to me about this, though, is that there is a finite amount of Bitcoins that they're creating. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're creating a run on diamonds and somebody's going to, you know, De Beers is going to get off, you know, their blood diamonds and flood the market.
It's a programmed obsolescence. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. There's
a ceiling that's programmed into it.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's a worldwide demand. It's not like it's just, you know, Asia that's controlling it, or if it's just Western society that's controlling Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It seems like worldwide there's a demand for it.
So this Wall Street veteran, Michael Novogratz, said at the CoinDesk Consensus Invest Conference on November 28th, Bitcoin could be at 40 grand at the end of 2018. It easily could. The algorithm that John McAfee used to predict Bitcoin's growth said that Bitcoin by the end of this year should have been at 5,000. Instead, it's at close to 20,000. And so his prediction was that by 2020, Bitcoin would be at 500,000. Now he's revised that and he's saying 1,000,000. If you think about it, though, the actual math that he ran against this, it's not just double, it's four times the amount. So it could be at 2,000,000.
Yeah, but I think that's also assuming if there was only one type of crypto standard, Bitcoin, well, that everybody was on, you just more and more being created.
Well, yeah, and so that's a big question on the market too. Is, you know, I think Ethereum's at about $475 right now, and Litecoin's at $99, and Litecoin's fluctuated up and down between $79 and like $120.
But those other ones are like RC Cola. This is like the Coca Cola.
Yeah, I mean Pepsi makes a lot of money though.
Yeah,
RC's right. Still around.
Sure,
there's a tab in the refrigerator out there if you want one.
Sure, but it seems like Bitcoin is the gold standard that everybody else is being compared to.
Yeah, but if you look at the countries that are going to lean heavily on this, are they going to lean towards money that's easily moved back and forth and very transactional? You know, do they really need a currency that is $20,000 per share, or do they need something that's under $100? So if I need to buy $100 worth of drugs in Mexico,
you can still buy those. You can still buy those smaller amounts, though. Yeah,
hypothetically,
yeah. Not that Matt would ever do that, but when you think about that though, people are trading in fractional Bitcoin right now. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's, you mm-hmm. know, that's, I certainly can't afford to buy a bunch of Bitcoin. Right. I might be able to buy a quarter of a Bitcoin.
Yeah. And if you do, heaven help you, if you lose your encrypted drive that has your keys on it. I mean, there's stories of like, you know, oh, I lost 7,500 Bitcoins. Oh, well, that was worth 7.5 million.
Whoops.
Gone.
Wait, so what happens to that? Do you guys know? It's gone forever.
Gone.
So that would be like Kurgan getting destroyed. It's just
correct.
In this case, did you take that 7,500 out of circulation? Those are unique coins.
They're gone. Yep, they're gone.
They're gone, right?
Which then would drive the valuation up, because it makes it more rare.
Exactly.
I'm going to be over here verifying my bank account real quick.
And I'm going to back up my hard drive. Hang on one second.
Buying some Litecoin while we're talking about this.
Let's make our own currency.
But it is an interesting idea. Think of what's driving the demand for this. It seems like either people are worried about the worldwide economy,
or they don't feel stocks are as safe, or they're viewing this as a bubble and they want to get on the way up before it pops to make money, or they're viewing it as a long-term investment. I mean, it seems like there's a whole multitude of reasons why people are getting into it.
Yeah. So,
and I guess you could say the bubble started back when Bitcoin was $10 and it went to 1,000. That could have been a bubble, but it kept going. I mean, it had a few corrections along the way.
It's doubled in the last 10 days. So, I mean, sure. It's got some real legs, and it's real easy to double when you're under, you know, under 1,000, you double. But now at 16, 17, 18.
But it's also easy to double when you don't have government regulation, like, you know, stock market exchange, when they stop the ticker and they have basically a timeout to correct things, right? Yeah. So there's no government regulation to time out things. This is a completely unregulated market.
Yeah, that you're right. That is interesting about it because now it's kind of the Wild West when you think about how this is working, because there's no governing body that regulates this. It's all and it's also
markets don't close. They're open 24/7 around the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And you're right, the Rockefellers, the mm-hmm. whoever, the World Bank, IMF, there's no controlling this, which I think it'll be interesting to see how organizations like that, CFR and Bilderbergs and whatever, I mean, wherever your tinfoil hat takes you, it'll be interesting to see what those organizations try to do to this mm-hmm. currency, because you really are changing the playing field. This is not, and when you think about it, when you talk about the petrodollar, when you think about that process too, we've been concerned about the yuan, and going to a, you know, moving off the dollar standard. What about cryptocurrency? Now add to that the complexity of artificial intelligence and how people are beginning to leverage that. This truly is a brave new world. Skynet's not only coming, it's here. Right. We're going to talk more about this next week when Zach is in. It's a good teaser though. I've certainly, you know, again, back in 2013, Mike and I really dug into what it would take to do that. I wish I would have invested. In fact, I think Mike told me, he's like, hey man, you know, if you got a couple grand, you should throw that in there. Wish I would have listened to you.
Yeah. I think that was towards the end though, when like a homegrown person could mine it. I think at that point it was starting to get phased out because you can't keep up with the ever changing demands of mining.
That's right.
Because it keeps getting more and more complex. Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. Well, like I said, next week's episodes, we're going to dig into this a little deeper. Danny boy, what do you got?
Somebody's watching you. Actually, I can't get that song unstuck from my head now.
I always feel like somebody's watching me.
I gotta get no privacy.
I was wondering if they put like hidden cameras in the studio or something.
Right, exactly. So along those lines, and we've heard this story happen a few times over the years, going back to actually 2005, there's occurrences of this type of story where a manufacturer, let's say it rhymes with HP. they make a keyboard.
Wow.
Right?
That was the lamest thing I've ever heard you say. And that's saying a lot.
I know that is saying an awful lot. So they OEM their keyboards out for manufacture. Okay. They're not one of those companies that makes their own keyboards. They say, hey, you know, OEM company over here, make my keyboards for me. Right. And then they have to come up with software drivers that work with those keyboards when you plug them into your computer. So that's the new one that's happening now, is basically the drivers and the software that recognize that keyboard, okay, from Hewlett Packard in this case, or HP. You plug it in, it activates the drivers. And in this case, unfortunately, the OEM's drivers were infected with a keylogger, okay?
Wait a second. No, they're actually saying that HP put it in there on purpose as a debug.
Right. We're going to get to that.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I'll shut up now.
Skipping ahead. It's okay. I appreciate that. And I encourage
Mr.
that.
Mr. Gregory.
Yes.
Mr. Gregory.
David has his hand up. Yes.
Respect the bullet points.
I just need a hall pass.
That's third time today, Mr. Glenn. Sorry.
I have a weak bladder.
Irresponsible and churlish.
So this happens and these drivers are activated and they start logging all your keystrokes, right? Okay. So... And you're right, Dave. They would later say, after they were kind of found out, that it was just kind of a test mode, where we're actually just doing it as a debug trace. Okay, so I've got a couple questions on this, but I'm skipping ahead now in my own story before I get too far ahead of myself. They have these things, and they come out all the time. In 2005, Apple keyboards had one, exactly the same situation. But in this case, Apple makes their own keyboards and drivers, okay? So it came directly from Apple. 2015.
What's their excuse, though?
Well, they would all, they all have different ones. If you research these stories, Apple had a different excuse. The NSA's hard drive firmware hack in 2015, that was a huge one. They had a different excuse. HP has the excuse of the debug trace. They all have a different way of kind of deflecting it. My question is, why even have something in place like, okay, for example, this HP one? Plug keyboard in, drivers activate, and I'm starting to I activate the keylogger, and it's recording every keystroke. Okay, and I can play that back. It's stored. It's actually recording all your keystrokes. Why even have something in there in debug mode or not that's recording all your keystrokes? I get you got to test stuff.
With that stuff,
I get that, but why have a driver with the capability of even doing that? Programmatically, to me, having been in the computer industry my entire life, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Would that get uploaded to HP, or was it just sitting
as part of HP's OS?
Yeah, but where does it go?
Yeah, so it's just staying locally. Is it staying locally?
Some agency with three letters in it.
Well, no.
Well, in this case, it's the DLL file that gets loaded with the operating system.
Yeah, so what this article is saying is that there's keylogger capabilities built into that, and hackers can go exploit that. Yeah. Typically, when you see stuff like that, I mean, years ago it was VNC. I don't know if you guys remember the VNC client, but that was a great early terminal services.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
Virtual network computing.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. Don't speak for me.
Love VNC.
Don't speak for me.
Oh, it was such a time saver administratively.
Rachel, what do you think about this? Keyloggers installed on laptops. And by the way, did you immediately like think, do I got any HPs laying around?
Well, actually, it made me think about some companies that may be going, oh, wow. What if my legal department was using one of these puppies?
Legal, HR, finance. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Crazy.
Right.
So what do you think about this from a corporate responsibility perspective? Rachel, weigh in on this.
Well, I want to go back to Dan's, sort of question about why was it even there in the first place? Because I think, Dan, what your thought was, why isn't there another piece of software that was doing this capability for the testing? Why did it have to be like built into the driver itself?
Right.
Yeah, that does seem pretty extreme. And it also
use something like BombGuard or something like that.
Right? So, and then let alone to release something out into the public without really knowing what exactly is inventoried on that device before you just put it out to the wild. And you know, where does that corporate responsibility, start and end with these people too, when they do something like this? Mm-hmm. So it's a good point.
Right. And it's not the first time this same company actually has been caught with the same type of problem.
Twice this year.
Twice in this last year alone. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously a pattern here, but I want to throw it out to this group. Let's kind of make it a little bit of a higher level conversation. You own a network. Let's say it's a corporate environment and there's 10,000 computers in it, right? And they're spread over a couple different countries. So it's a fairly good sized, medium sized company, not global, but they're big. And you've got various different pieces of hardware, software, and everything else. As things happen, you buy locally in those areas where price makes sense and shipping doesn't cost $1 million and everything else. So you got different standards. Okay, you buy IBM, but all of them are slightly different model numbers and they all have slightly different software versions and different operating system patches and such for different reasons. And at any one point in time, none of them are they're not all on the same page. They can't be. It's just physically almost impossible right now with technology the way it is. How would you go about saying, okay, how many HP, and the model numbers are listed here, HP Model 460 laptops do I have in my environment with this particular driver? How would you, I mean, the challenge around that, and specifically which ones are using this version of the actual firmware on these drivers for this particular keyboard? There's got to be a way for you to be able to answer that question if you're responsible in your duties as an IT professional for an enterprise-sized company.
Well, now you're talking incident response, right? Yeah, it just became an incident, and going through that process and understanding what is there, what the impact is, what department.
Yeah.
And going through that activity because now you've got basically, a potential issue and need to understand what it, if it is.
So even before incident response, would you say that it's – if I don't have an accurate way to inventory and do asset discovery and have a fairly accurate level of, I should be able to answer that question with a couple clicks of a button saying I have 50 of those and they're in these different countries and they're owned by these end users because I cross-referenced that with my asset management system.
People could actually say that?
That's an extreme. That was painting the extreme.
Yeah, that's right? I mean, that's not really reality.
I think most companies struggle to do that within a department. You know, if there's 50 right. people in the department, go, here's my assets for this department of 50.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought that up, Dave, because it is an extreme. It doesn't have to be, because mm-hmm. it really isn't anywhere half as hard as a lot of people think it is.
And when you think about it, this is an easy button mm-hmm. that almost nobody does.
Right.
Because we've allowed ourselves to, I mean, think about it in different industries. You can sort of check a box here. If you're a healthcare organization, your physicians, you've let things run wild a little bit because of BYOD or because of people making decisions because of relationships or whatever. But, mm-hmm. but the reality is we should be able to handle stuff like this.
Yeah.
There's a couple of lenses to look at this through. One is from a corporate perspective. I'm looking at you, Rachel, because I'm interested to hear your perspective on this. From a corporate perspective, sometimes I've seen people use this as a little bit of a hammer to say, okay, see, I told you we need to invest in an inventory control system because otherwise we don't, you know, whatever. Or I've seen people use this in to be able to say, hey, we need to move all our spend to Dell or whatever.
No, you got a good point. I mean, it's very hard for people to change their business processes. So if your IT department is obviously not maybe taking care of these inventory issues yeah. like they should be, then all of a sudden when something happens, it really becomes the, all right, here it is.
Right.
And especially as us in security, that seems to be, unfortunately, what we end up doing a lot of times is saying, I told you so.
And you hope that you can leverage somebody else's experience to do that because it really sucks if it's yours.
That's for sure, yeah. right? Yeah. yeah. And of course, it comes back to, too, being able to, again, understand the risk. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to be able to say, look, we dodged this one because we know all of our ducks are in a row.
Sure.
You know, mm-hmm. we don't have this particular, you know, device that has this problem. Mm-hmm. We're all good. Let's go on to the next thing.
All right.
So, without getting too personally into that, and Dan and Rachel, you guys are of this group. I mean, it's been the only network I ever owned was an educational network. So I haven't been really in this position. What is your tendency if this happens to somebody else? What is your tendency for how you use that? Would you always in that position? Would you always leverage something like is this something? Mm-hmm. Is this something, Dan? If you're still a CIO, is this something that you immediately take to the management team and say, listen, you know, I wanted to remember when I told you that thing about making sure that we standardize on this vendor and that we yeah. you know we need an inventory control system. Do you do that with this stuff? What's the balance between leveraging this too much so that you become Peter and the Wolf, you know, or being able to effectively manage it. And same question for you, Rachel, when he's
right. So if it's this particular use case, right. And, mm-hmm. and it depends on the use case. This one, actually, I would consider to be, on the lower end of the scale, okay. but let's say it's a lower end of the scale type yeah. of example. I go to my people and I say, listen, I just read this last
you
night.
People.
Well, I would have gone to my people.
Okay,
I don't have people sure. anymore. I don't. I just kind of say I have finger puppets and I call them my people.
Sock puppets.
So I go to my team at the time and I say, listen, guys, how many other people here are aware of this and have read it? We get a little bit of a consensus and I say, listen, just do a scan for me. Find how many we have.
Yeah.
And I'll try to run ahead of it in my next board meeting. I'll bring it up as a bullet point. This would actually literally boil up as a bullet point because you're absolutely right. You don't want to be the guy who cries wolf. Say, listen,
so this is part of a bigger story. You talk about you talk about the recent healthcare breach mm-hmm. with our friends that anyway.
Right. And then I bring, oh, by the way, you might have read a story about these laptops and everything.
Okay.
You don't need it. We got it covered. We already identified them, took care of it, moving on with business.
Okay.
You try not to do that. There's a balance, but you got to do that consistently. That way they're like, wow, he's ahead of it. He's reading the same things we do. And he's already got a response for us before I even think to call him at 2 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday. So, sure. Oh my God, I just read this article. Don't worry about it. We've got it all covered. So you really want to establish that.
Because you actually get a lot of those calls.
I get a lot of those calls. Yeah, get a lot of those. And we're trying to help, you know, our customers be that type of person, that C-level executive. But you try not to be too dramatic about it. In fact, I try to downplay most of it because you don't want to be the radical, fanatic kind of CIO who's always dramatic and the sky is falling and I need more money to make these problems go away. you won't be taken seriously. You have to, you know, have a balance.
So you think there's a happy medium on that?
I think there is.
What about you, Rachel?
Oh, Rachel.
Yeah, I agree. I think there is a happy medium. I think it's good to broadcast it out to some extent to basically say, hey, there's some lessons learned here for everybody.
Yeah, good point.
You know, and just sort of be on the education side. Hey, we need to be aware of what our vendors are doing, what's going on in this space, how it might affect us, and maybe even just do some internal, mm-hmm. you know, investment like you're talking about in terms of what your processes are, you know, reviews and what have you, just to sort of see what's going on. And some things don't even cost money in order to improve the security.
That's a great point. Sometimes it's configuration. Sometimes it's,
yeah.
Right.
It's taking, I mean, I'm a sales guy now. I used to be technical. I used to know stuff, but now I just sell stuff. But it's interesting. It's interesting that you say that because I think that sometimes we overplay that. Especially guys like me, we're like, oh, check it out. You gotta look at this. And it becomes FUD and nobody respects us in the morning. So
you have to approach it a certain way. Yeah. You surely do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
As a marketing guy, I gotta look at myself in the mirror every morning and say, you know,
I like myself. Gosh darn it, people like me.
People like me.
I have a question for you guys in the industry. For most companies that would order a laptop from a company like this, would you just run it straight out of the box, or would you guys do your own, I guess, cleaning up of things before you hand it out to employees?
Yeah, before you put gold anything image. In your network, anything before anything sees a light of day on your network, there's a dev test prod or a UAT test or some kind of validation process where it's scrubbed, it's loaded with your image, it's configuration hardened, and then ideally it's then given to either the end user or plugged onto the network somewhere. Now, again, that's ideal. Most times it goes right from box to end user, and then there you go. That's realistic.
Is there any reason that a company wouldn't completely wipe the hard drive clean, reformat it, and then install Windows or whatever operating system they're using on top of it?
Depends on the size and complexity of the organization. Yeah. Some of them have deals with the OEMs.
Go ahead.
I was going to say those small businesses or single, you know, owner, you know, type scenario, they don't have an IT department at all do that.
And if it's BYOD, you don't have any. I mean, usually they go, hey, here are the minimum specs.
Good luck.
Install the security software, mm-hmm. use this MDM or whatever. That's a really good point. The size of the organization, the commitment from the executive team to have things be the more of a standard you can set, the easier it is to manage. But sometimes that's not, you know, in a lot of manufacturing companies, you see engineers have a specific type of machine, but then you have these engineers that they're, you know, some of them like to draw with a Mac and some of them like to draw with, you know, specific software for PC or whatever. And so you've got a lot of disparate systems from a manufacturing perspective. Retail tend to be able to standardize a little better from a retail perspective. And just like these guys said, there's a lot of people that build gold images and they'll ship to the manufacturer. Manufacturer actually installs those images before it goes out to the organization. Slightly smaller organizations often do that. You know, they'll have their own gold image and roll that out. All the way down to organizations that don't have any standardization, but they do have a specific set of applications that they deploy. The more control you can get, you know, John Thompson from Symantec years ago said a well-managed endpoint is a secure endpoint. And the fact of the matter is that any endpoint device within your organization that you have control over, the best control you can have is have that be a managed system where you're monitoring the health of the application on there, where you're monitoring application usage, you're metering application usage and understanding how those applications are being used. And then you're removing anything that's extemporaneous, you know, that's extra. If you're not using an application on a device, you should remove it. It's going to minimize the attack surface. And it's going to allow you to increase performance, and it's going to allow you to manage that better. Is that right or no?
Agreed. Although in this particular case that we started talking about it was in that. No, it was in the driver. So
yeah,
nobody's going to make their own driver, no, even if they're a large company. Mm-hmm. So
you got a really good point there. Sorry, I went way off the use case. We started talking about general best practices. I think it went way off the use case.
Right.
So Rachel, how, like, back around to this. Mm-hmm. How do you, there's no way to avoid this, right? I mean, you just got
to. That's what it starts becoming like now that we went full circle.
It's a reactive situation. But really again, if you're on top of it and you're getting intelligence feeds and you're reading, you know, the latest, news information feeds and whatever, and your team is all plugged in and proactively adding things to the table in your daily, weekly meetings, you can run ahead of it and be proactive. I mean, before it becomes an issue or potentially becomes an issue.
And even potentially some monitoring. I mean, somebody probably at some point went, hey, why is this, computer talking to URL or this IP address?
Right.
So that's a key point.
So behavior.
Behavior analytics. Yeah. The whole idea of behavioral analytics that, we're getting more into this situation where we want to profile our users and profile devices and entities within, and sorry, I'm going to go back to a new industry term, but that UEBA, that whole user and entity behavioral analysis, it's important to be able to monitor and track those things. Mm-hmm. So, guys, just from a wrap perspective, I think the key items here are knowledge is power, and the more information that you have, the more standardization you have, the ability to watch and understand. What you're actually doing within your infrastructure, what devices you have, and the ability to correlate that data and boil it down to something that's actually consumable. That's really where you have the best control. Maddie, where can people find us? I think we're done with this segment, right?
Yeah. This will wrap up segment one. When we come back in segment two, we're going to talk about PCI compliance, a little bit more in, have Rachel kind of dive in with Dana as well in the compliance field.
Why can't I talk about it?
We can attempt to talk about it, but I feel like they're going to outclass us on this one. We can outkick our coverage.
Okay, fine. Where do you find us, Matt?
Securityjabber.com. Also on Twitter, @securityjabber. And then in Facebook, facebook.com/secjabber. Again, this is going to wrap up segment one. And segment two, we'll do PCI compliance. And segment three, we'll do an interview with Rachel.
Sweet. Zuckerberg?
I sent him a telegraph. I wasn't waiting to hear back from him.
Damn. Send the Pony Express next time. Peace. Thanks, everyone. Swatching.